You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 29th of May 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the programme, the imminent travails of first son-in-law Jared Kushner. Will his back channel to Moscow be his exit from the White House? Angela Merkel's apparent acknowledgement that Europe will have to look after itself while Donald Trump remains President of the United States. What will that mean in practice? We'll ask what Emmanuel Macron hoped to gain by beating up on Russian media while standing next to Vladimir Putin. We'll look at the past and future of Canada's new opposition leader, and we'll find out why we shouldn't judge by appearances. And a bit later in the programme.
From the moment news broke of a big screen interpretation of the classic 90s television series Baywatch, predictions of its beaching at the box office were rolling in, almost like an unwelcome storm front rudely interrupting a summer's afternoon.
And we'll review the Asian newspapers, all that and more coming up in the next 60 minutes on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. But first, a quick look at the day's other top stories. North Korea has conducted yet another missile test, its third in as many weeks. This one appears to have been a Scud, a Soviet-built short-range ballistic missile. It travelled roughly 450 kilometres from launch and landed in Japanese waters, prompting protests from Tokyo and other capitals wearying of Pyongyang's provocations. British Airways CEO Alex Cruz has rejected suggestions that he resign in the wake of a massive IT failure which marooned more than 75,000 passengers in 170 airports in 70 countries. Mr. Cruz explained that the outage was due to a power surge rather than anything more sinister, and that a backup system had failed to operate as anticipated. He denied that recent cost-cutting was a factor. Australia is to increase by slightly over 10% its contribution of troops to Afghanistan in response to a request from the United States, which is considering deploying 3,000 more troops to lead the fight against the Taliban. Australia will send a further 30 military advisers, raising Australia's commitment to Afghanistan to 300 soldiers. And the royal family of Belgium has taken umbrage and indeed action at a well-known fast food merchant which co-opted in its advertising King Philippe, inviting visitors to a website to choose between him and the burger merchant's mascot. Retainers at the Royal Castle of Laeken have asked that the treasonous gimmick be desisted with. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Last week, it became known that Jared Kushner, the senior White House counsel, whose qualifications consist of being married to the president's daughter, was a focus of investigation into his father-in-law's links to Russia. Over the weekend, the nature of his alleged malfeasance became somewhat clearer. Mr. Kushner, it appears, had discussed with Russian officials the possibility of opening up some sort of back-channel line of communications. This could scarcely look more suspicious if Mr. Kushner had, at the time, been wearing a trench coat with an upturned collar and a low-brimmed trilby. But is it? I'm joined now by David Usborne, Chief North America Commentator at The Independent. David, first of all, the most vital and most difficult question where Trump's White House is concerned, what do we actually know for sure?
Well, we do know that Kushner is in a bit of trouble, as you mentioned, and we know more specifically that this arises from a meeting that he had with the Russian ambassador to the U.S., Ambassador Kislyak, during the transition, at which he suggested that there might be some opportunity for back-channel communications between the transition team and Moscow. And Kislyak reported the approach that Kushner had made to the Kremlin, and U.S. intelligence, as it does, monitors these conversations between the Russian embassy on Massachusetts Avenue and Moscow, and caught Kislyak, you know, informing the Kremlin of what Kushner had requested, and that's how it came to light. So what was initially a fairly sort of vague report that came out last week, as you say, got more specific and more clear over the weekend. And of course, as it gets more clear, so the trouble for Kushner would appear to get more deep.
Now, do we understand potentially how much trouble he is in?
Well, as is true, I think, of this whole swirling Russian nebulous over the White House, the answer is not really. We don't know, for example, whether the key allegation of, in the midst of all of this, which is that somehow Russia and the Trump campaign and or transition team were sort of in cahoots with Kremlin, is true or not. And it's worth always repeating that there's no evidence of that, and that maybe it's something short of deliberate collusion, and therefore something short of something impeachable. And, you know, what Kushner was up to, why he did it, who asked him to do it, if anybody, are questions that we're still not able to answer. And therefore, it is quite difficult, which I think is what you're trying to get at here, you know, to gauge how much trouble he is in. I mean, he is in trouble insofar as, you know, it just deepens the one thing that Trump is desperate to get away from, which is this endless questioning about Russia. And it continues to embolden the Democrats, who today, by the way, have just demanded that Kushner lose his security clearance at the White House. Now, that may not happen, but it's an illustration of how the blood continues to seep from outside the White House doors, and it's none of this is good for Trump, and it must irk him deeply that the one person he is seen to trust the most, Jared Kushner, the Dauphin, if you like, is now the person who's bringing him the greatest trouble.
Well, Kushner, as you suggest, is somebody that Trump clearly regards highly, which sort of elevates him to a fairly meagre and exclusive aristocracy. If Kushner is effectively unsackable, if he does choose to go of his own accord, how damaged and isolated does that leave Trump?
Yes, poor old Donald. He would be a bit embattled at that point, wouldn't he?
Possibly even downright beleaguered.
Yeah, beleaguered indeed. One of our favourite words in the profession. It's difficult to know. I don't think at this point there is nothing to suggest that Kushner is contemplating leaving. But I would also say that the premise of your question, that he's untouchable and that Trump will always stand by him, may not be true. We're beginning to see reports of Trump actually letting slip remarks inside the West Wing that seem to reveal irritation with his son-in-law. He especially, apparently, was aggravated that Jared Kushner's sisters was in China recently trying to lure some Chinese investments for a deal that the Kushner company is doing in New Jersey, and in doing so seemed to dangle the idea that she could deliver them some visas. Now, that would go, if that's true, that sort of totally undermines Trump's immigration message. It undermines the notion that somehow Trump business is separate from Trump government and presidency, which is dubious in the first place. So I think that, you know, there may be a shortening of patience actually with Trump, with his son-in-law. Now, if that's the case, his position there would be looking a little bit more fragile.
What do we make of, well, I don't know if defense is the right word, but certainly semi-defense of Kushner by people like National Security Advisor Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, who sort of, without addressing the Kushner thing specifically, said that there was, in general, nothing either unusual or terribly wrong with administration officials having back-channel communications with one country or another?
I think a lot of people see, you know, McMaster coming out and defending Trump with increasing frequency as a rather sad display of, you know, a man with and hitherto unbesmirched reputation kind of throwing himself under the bus for his boss. John Kelly, the Homeland Security Secretary, also at the weekend suggesting that there's nothing wrong with setting up back channels. In fact, he said he thought it was rather a good thing. Well, I mean, I think most critics would say, what are you talking about? And while it might be okay for sitting presidents and administrations to find novel ways to communicate with other countries. It's not okay when you're not actually in the Oval Office yet. You know, don't forget, President Barack Obama was in charge of the country when this was going on. And, you know, asking for a back channel with a country that clearly is the United States' adversary, that we already knew by then was had been trying to meddle and change the course of the election. You know, it sounds a lot to many people like something that is, well, frankly, treasonous. So it's kind of startling, frankly, that they should come out and say those things. However, of course, they have to, and it's pretty sad to witness.
David Usborne from The Independent, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer, or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
This is the Monocle Daily, live from Studio One at Midori House in London. Now, from most other leaders, it might have been regarded as a gaffe, one of those off-record and/or hot mic moments in which a politician is overheard saying what they actually think. However, nothing in the long career of German Chancellor Angela Merkel has hinted at a tendency towards such mishap. When she said at a campaign rally this weekend that it was time for Europe to take its fate into its own hands, it seems vastly likelier than not that she knew exactly what she was doing. Well, I'm joined now by Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Sebastian, the Chancellor also said that the era in which we could fully rely on others is over to some extent. Now, that was a typically cautious qualifier, the "to some extent" there. Do we know to what extent she means?
Yes, you've caught her rhetorical style down to a T, Andrew. She will never make a good public speaker, unfortunately. All these alliterations, and anyway, never mind. I think she said more or less the same thing about 3 months ago. This is something which she's saying to two audiences, obviously to America. I think she was extremely displeased with the president, and she, in her own inimical way, she made that clear. She's also saying it to the domestic audience, and when she talks about greater responsibility and getting together in Europe, of course, there are two messages there. First, we, the Germans, we need to spend more money, particularly on defense, because we are, to an absolutely unacceptable degree, relying on the Americans, you know, for our defense. And secondly, part of this Europe is a number of fiscally incontinent countries in the south of the continent, and we will have to put more money towards that.
She's saying this obviously against a backdrop, I guess, of two major factors. One is the Donald Trump aberration in the United States. The other is Brexit here in the UK. As you mentioned, she is, of course, facing an election. She is speaking to the voters. How comfortable are those voters with the idea that Germany may have to take a more central role, not only in Europe, in the leadership of Europe, but in the defence of Europe?
That's the point, Andrew. They aren't. They are not. They have got used to the idea that they go out and export cars all over the world and leave the defense of the realm and of the continent to others. And that's exactly what has to stop. And she, in fact, should, in my view, be much more open about that, and be much more forthcoming about the costs involved. Because there is a very lazy anti-Americanism in German society, which of course is fed by this madness emanating from the White House, and I'm not saying she's feeding that, but she's riding that wave, and that can become very, very dangerous, I think, particularly because of course her adversary, from the Social Democrats, Martin Schulz, is saying more or less the same thing, or indeed saying it in slightly tougher terms, thereby echoing what Social Democrat Chancellor Gerhard Schröder said about 15 years ago.
She is obviously a very smart and very canny electoral operator. She hasn't been Chancellor of Germany for 12 years by accident. But is this just possible that she does perceive that there is electoral advantage in beating up on Donald Trump? She also made a reference to anyone who puts on national blinkers and no longer has eyes for the world around him is, I am convinced, ultimately out on a limb. Now, she didn't mention anyone by name, but it's not difficult to figure out who she's talking about there, is it?
Look, I think even convinced transatlanticists like Angela Merkel, like, dare I say it myself, are totally desperate about what we see. We see the nation that has led the free world for 70 years abrogating its responsibility, voting for a complete fool in the White House who is behaving, abominably. And we all saw the pictures. I mean, you can't paper over those problems. The same that you can't paper over the fact that Britain decided willy-nilly to abandon the Western Alliance and make problems by voting for Brexit. Nobody likes that, and it's a lose-lose situation for Britain and for the EU. But Angela Merkel and the rest of the continent will have to deal with it. And I think it's despair rather than anger in both cases. But what it means is the European Union, and that does in the end mean under German leadership, under Angela Merkel's leadership, will have to step up to the plate and commit more money, more energy, in the end, I suppose, also more blood and treasure towards being a force for good in the world.
On the subject, just finally and just briefly, of Trump's abominable, as you put it, behaviour, what did you make of today's statement by Martin Schulz, Angela Merkel's chief opponent, who took considerable umbrage on Merkel's behalf, saying that this, whatever he may disagree with her about, this was no way for Trump to treat the leader and the representative of Germany. Was that sincere patriotic outrage or a bit of opportunist electioneering from Schulz?
I suspect the latter. I mean, it's very difficult. You have to have sympathy with the guy. You know, it's so difficult for him, particularly in a phase where the Chancellor is seen on the world stage and is seen to behave properly and has her allies around her. And what is he supposed to do? I mean, he could either say, "Oh, she's terrible," or he can do what he did, basically support her and go slightly over the top.
Sebastian Borger from Berliner Zeitung, thanks as always for joining us, rather easy for me to say. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. It was Oscar Wilde who asserted that only the shallow do not judge by appearances, an attempt perhaps to excuse something we do all the time, whether we enjoy admitting that to ourselves or not. Most of us do probably have some idea that it's the wrong thing to do, so why do we do it? I'm joined now by Alex Todorov from the Department of Psychology at Princeton and author of the new book Face Value, The Irresistible Influence of First Impressions. And Alex, I'm sitting here now absolutely terrified about the first impression I might have made in the last few seconds.
Well, it shouldn't be. I'm highly mistrustful of this kind of impressions when it comes to reading the character of the person.
So what does comprise our first impression of somebody? Because, you know, it is something we do all the time, every day. I don't think I'm alone in this. We make snap judgments about people we see sitting opposite us on the train, in the street, new colleagues, new friends, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. I mean, and this is partly one of the main points of the book, that in a sense, most of us explicitly deny physiognomy as something that should be practiced, and it shouldn't be, but it's something that occurs and happens all the time. And I mean, we have many studies that you can flush a face for less than 1/10 of a second, and that provides sufficient information for people to make all sorts of judgments, like whether the person is trustworthy, whether they're competent, aggressive, and so on and so on.
So why do we do that? Is there some, you know, hardwired evolutionary imperative for it?
Well, I don't think that there's hardwired evolutionary imperative for reading character from faces, but if there's any argument to be made, there's certainly we are biologically prepared to try to figure out the intentions of the other people here and now. This is something that is very important. I mean, if you think about evolution, and often there's some evolutionary hypothesis that perhaps this is hardwired, but let's imagine that human evolution is compressed within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. For most of the time, we have lived in very small groups, essentially extended families, from 5, 6 to 80, 100. And in these kinds of groups, you don't really need to rely on first impressions because you have substantive information about the people around you. And what changes modern states appear in the last 5 minutes of this 24-hour day. So it's a fairly recent phenomena. And then suddenly you live with thousands of strangers and you cannot possibly have knowledge. I mean, Jared Diamond had a nice line in one of his books that this was the first time in the human history when you have to encounter strangers without attempting to kill them.
is it those judgments that we make, though, is it something more complicated and deeper than just the fact that we are, and we are, predisposed to think well of people we find physically attractive? We will give more time of day and cut more slack to somebody we think is good-looking.
Right. Definitely, there's much more to attractiveness. There's enormous work on attractiveness, and what you describe, people will say, maybe you have this attractiveness halo, and that colors all of your judgments. But in fact, you can... For example, we built different statistical models that can visualize all sorts of impressions. So I can have a model of trustworthiness, I can have a model of attractiveness, and all of this is actually richly illustrated in the book. I can subtract the attractiveness, so I can create a face that is unattractive but trustworthy, and I can have a face that is attractive but trustworthy. And if it's some kind of an investment situation or something that requires your trust, people are more likely to trust the so-called unattractive but trustworthy face rather than the...
Are those judgments universal, that model of what we might think of as a mocked-up trustworthy or untrustworthy face? Is that going to be broadly reacted to the same everywhere you go? Are there any adjustments that you make for race, for example?
Well, not quite. Actually, yes and no. Because so, when you build these kinds of models, what is important, you can actually discover the different cues that people are using. So one of the cues is emotional expressions, which probably, so faces that resemble kind of smiling or faces that resemble positive expressions, they're perceived as trustworthy. That could obviously vary within the same person if you have different images or depending on what kind of day you're having. And faces that look like they have a negative expression are perceived as untrustworthy. You would expect that these signals will be similar across cultures. Another major input is masculinity, femininity. So we tend to trust feminine faces, and it goes with the gender stereotypes. But then there are other inputs to trustworthiness, which are very culturally specific.
Mm-hmm.
Cultural typicality is very important, what you perceive as a typical face. So you can think of this major distinction that we do between in-group, our own group, and out-groups. And so faces that resemble typical faces, we tend to like and trust, and atypical faces, we tend to dislike and distrust.
So this country is, as you've doubtless noticed, currently in the grip of a general election. Do these sort of reflexes and these judgments affect the way people vote?
Yes, in fact, the very first studies that we did and which got me interested in studying first impressions was trying to predict political elections in the United States. This was initially was predicting the election outcomes of the U.S. Senate. And the very, very surprising outcome is that relying on snapshot judgments of people who didn't recognize the politicians, they didn't even know that they were judging politicians. If you aggregate with a relatively small sample size of 40 naive participants, we could predict about 70% of the outcome of the Senate races.
So does this lead to a point at which that knowledge could be deployed by somebody seeking political office? Are there expressions and ticks you can adopt that will make that kind of good first impression?
I'm sure that it is. I mean, I've heard from a political scientist friend that some consultants in Mexico were using this, but as a general rule, I don't do consulting and I don't work with political campaigns, but absolutely. I mean, one thing I have to, there's a caveat here. You know, the way it works on real voters is this are typically voters who are completely unknowledgeable. They know very little about politics and exposed to TV. So these are the people, from a psychological point of view, the way we think about making decisions is that many decisions, even complex decisions, we rely on shortcuts. We rely on heuristics.
Of course, we haven't got time to think everything all
exactly,
the way through.
Exactly. So if you're not a highly invested voter, but nevertheless you decided to vote, the easiest shortcut is your first impression. Because it's easy. I mean, you don't have to think, you don't have to ponder. You've seen the politician, you already made up your mind.
Is there anything at all revealing of a person's character from the way they look, from that first impression? And I'm asking mostly because one of my favourite quotations from George Orwell, and which I do believe to be true more often than it isn't, is that at the age of 50, all men have the face they deserve.
Well, I love George Orwell, but of course, these kinds of quotations could be interpreted in multiple ways. And I have a chapter in the book called Life Leaves Traces on Our Faces, and it turns out that if you look at twins, so if you look at people, so the elderly people, the biggest predictor of mortality is obviously your biological age, but the next one is how old you look relative to a biological age. So people who look younger are more likely to live longer. And so, but what is happening here? Well, let's look at the ingredients. Number one, besides genetic luck, if you have a high socioeconomic status, which comes with better access to healthcare, if you're not chronically exposed to sun, like being a fisherman or a farmer, if you don't smoke, these are the things that contribute to your appearance. So certainly by the age of 50, your face, in a sense, will reflect your lifestyle. Is this a character? Well, to some extent, but to a larger extent, it's also life circumstances.
Well, just finally then, obviously, if the book's central thesis is that we over-rely on first impressions and that probably we should try to rise above them. Is there any way, however, that you can, I guess, come back from having made a poor first impression, whether it was by, you know, accident or mishap or whatever?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we change our minds all the time. The question is whether you will have the opportunity to receive reliable information. Because often the first impression would be almost like the gatekeepers, right? You decide whether the person deserves a second chance or not, and this is it. Maybe you have a prospective employee who could be incredibly creative, but the first impression is bad. They never got to the second stage of the interview process. So it very much depends. But if you have opportunities to interact with the person, and to get reliable information, surely. But we rarely go around life trying to test our hunches rigorously.
afraid not. Alex Todorov, author of Face Value, The Irresistible Influence of First Impressions. Thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. French President Emmanuel Macron described today's meeting in Versailles with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin as a frank exchange. This, as connoisseurs of diplomatic language will be aware, is a small but significant step down from the dreaded full and frank exchange. We may therefore surmise that while voices may have been raised, no ceremonial crockery was actually flung. President Macron, however, did not pull punches at the subsequent joint press news press conference. He laid exuberantly into state-sponsored Russian news agencies RT and Sputnik as organs of influence, propaganda, and false propaganda. That's the worst kind. I'm joined now by the Russia analyst Stephen Diehl. Stephen, I'm reminded of that conventional prison yard wisdom which holds that on your first day inside, the thing to do is to march up to the biggest guy in the yard and smack him one. Is that what Macron has done here?
Very nearly. I think it's hugely encouraging, actually, that he's taken such a strong stance, that he's shown Putin from the start he's not going to get pushed around. I mean, there were three main points that have come out so far. One, as you mentioned, you know, he said that the RT and Sputnik, which are not journalism. I mean, they are just propaganda. They're awful propaganda. And he's said so in so many words. Secondly, on Syria, he said, yes, you know, we need to cooperate. Obviously, ISIS, Daesh, so-called Islamic State, is a common enemy, but we will draw the line at chemical weapons. So in other words, he's pointing up the fact that the Russians lied about the Syrians using a chemical bomb. We know they used a chemical bomb. There's all the evidence is there. And the third one he took him to task on was there's been a lot of stories around lately about the treatment of gay men in Chechnya, which, of course, is part of the Russian Federation. There was a demonstration, indeed, in Paris, in front of the Eiffel Tower as well, saying Mr. Putin sought out Chechnya and, you know, and the rights of gay people there. So that's three big issues that he's gone straight in. And yeah, as you say, he's effectively given the Russian president something of a slap in the face.
President Putin, we know, places great store in Russia's prestige abroad and Russia's prestige generally. And I think to an extent, as Russian leaders tend to, sees himself as an embodiment of that. All that being the case, how personally is he likely to have taken this?
He probably won't have taken it too personally, but he will have been impressed. And that's why I admit I'm pleased that that President Macron has behaved in this way, because the problem in the West is often that we soft soap the Russians, and we if they do something we don't like, we sort of shilly-shally, and we try and get round it, and we try not to tell it straight, whereas he has told it to him straight. And actually, that means that Putin knows exactly where he stands with this French president.
RT and Sputnik, to the exceedingly minor credit of both, have reported Macron's criticisms of them. They've done it, you know, in fairly self-serving style, with quotes from their own executives saying, no, this is all terrible, terrible rubbish. But in fairness to them, they have reported it, which means that their readers and consumers will at least read and consume it. How influential are these two networks really? Are they actually influential, or are they playing some meta game where they enjoy playing up the idea that they're influential?
They do have, I find, rather depressing influence, actually. What should we call them? The liberal circles in the West, where there's a lot of cynicism about our own politics. That's what they play on. And people, intelligent, well-educated, well-read people will say, oh, well, you know, one has to look at this view that the Russian media is giving, and it's rather different. But they put out the most terrible lies. Two of the best examples in recent years have been the shooting down of MH17 in July 2014, the shooting down the Malaysian airliner over Ukraine, we know all the evidence is there that shows that this was shot down by a Russian missile fired by Russian troops in the Russian-occupied part of eastern Ukraine. It's all there. I won't go into it now, but it's there. And yet they put out so many different versions which actually contradicted themselves, because they don't actually care if anyone believes one particular version. They want people to believe nothing. They want people to be totally cynical about it. And then the other one was the one I've mentioned already, the Syrian chemical attack. Again, all the evidence is there, and yet they kept pushing the Russian line that said, no, this was a chemical dump that the rebels had, and that's what got hit by a bomb, which is complete nonsense.
You talk about that promotion of cynicism, which is clearly a thing they deliberately do. To that extent, how important a part of Putin's foreign policy are they? Because I can never quite tell myself whether in his interactions with the West, whether he actually has some specified endpoint in mind that he's working towards, or whether he just regards sowing chaos, confusion, cynicism as an end in itself.
It's the latter. He wants to make the West unsure. He wants Western society to doubt their own values. Because also it has a feedback into his own country. He is, you know, if you look at, he's been in power for 17 years in Russia, and yet if you look at the state of healthcare, the state of education, the state of society, no democracy, no real democracy, the place is in a mess. And this is 17 years on his watch. Now, any Western leader who'd been in power for 17 years would be ousted. He has elections coming up next year, but no one really doubts
that. Would you like to make a prediction?
I think he might win, and he might win even in the first round. So if he can feed back to his own people, and of course they are very limited in their sources of information. Everything comes now from the state. It's very much like in Soviet times. And Russians, when you're pumped all this stuff all the time, believe, oh, well, you know, the West's in trouble. I'll give you another small example. A couple of months ago, there was a shortage of lettuces. Because the weather meant there weren't too many. And we were told that we weren't able to buy more than 3 lettuces in one go in a supermarket chain in Britain. I've never bought more than 1 lettuce at a time anyway.
I did wonder who these people were.
Well,
yes.
Indeed. But then there was a picture of shops with sort of empty shelves where there should have been lettuces. And this was portrayed to the Russian people as, look at the food shortages that are happening in the West. And that is typical of Russian propaganda. So he wants, A, to disrupt people in the West, to make them doubt our own values and our own systems, but also to feed back into Russia and say, look, see how bad they are. Aren't you lucky you've got me?
But just finally and very briefly then, should more Western leaders follow Macron's cue?
Absolutely.
And take a pop at Putin in public?
Yes, I think they really should. And because the only other person who's really stood up to him up until now has been Merkel. Angela Merkel in Germany, she's also stood up to him and has said, look, you know, don't mess with me. You know, they describe her up until Macron, maybe Macron's the second, but there so far, you've heard the phrase probably, you know, Angela Merkel is the only European leader with balls. And she's certainly shown to Putin that she's not going to get messed around. He tried a trick on her when she was visiting him in the Kremlin. He let his dog into the room, knowing that she hates dogs and she's frightened of dogs. So there's psychological games going on there. But absolutely, that is the way to handle him. That is the way to handle Russians. You stand up to them and you say, you can't do this and we're not going to stand for it. And they actually respect that.
Stephen DL, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. This is The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, there is presently no idea in politics less original than deriding your opposition as highfalutin, out-of-touch elitist snobs with no idea of the lives of the ordinary worker beyond whatever conversations they might have with their gardeners. By that score, Canada's new opposition leader, Andrew Scheer of the Conservative Party, has revealed himself as being uninterested in being regarded as an innovator. He has already accused Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberals of taking their cues from the cocktail circuit, while he plans to heed the Legion Halls, soccer fields and grocery stores. Well, joining me with more is Adam Radwanski, a studio political features writer for The Globe and Mail. Adam, first of all, introduce, if you would, Canada's new opposition leader to us. Who basically is Andrew Scheer?
Andrew Scheer is a young MP, still in his late 30s, not terribly well known across the country. He's from Saskatchewan, which is a, you know, smallish province. His main profile to date would have been as Speaker of the House of Commons, which, of course, is a, you know, effectively a nonpartisan position. As an MP, he's been, you know, relatively low profile. He's considered to be on the sort of relative right side of the Conservative Party, socially conservative. But I think part of the appeal of him is that he's sort of a friendly face for the party, perceived to be kind of a relative sort of big tent conservative, somebody who's going to try and bring in different factions, along the line sort of Stephen Harper, who was the prime minister, the Conservative prime minister for the better part of a decade. In fact, the first elected leader of the Conservative Party, which is a relatively new party here. So they're essentially sticking with something along the lines of what they had before, but the idea being that maybe it's a slightly friendlier, younger face on it.
He wasn't widely expected to win this thing, was he? So how did it happen?
Well, he wasn't widely expected, but it actually did make sense if you were following it closely, because the way they did this was a preferential ballot, and there were a remarkable number of candidates. There were 13, 14 candidates at one point, 13 by the end. So nobody was going to win 50% of the votes, which was required on the first ballot, on first choice votes. And this, in fact, went all the way until there were just two people left. He won because he was a consensus candidate, effectively. I mean, the front runner and the person who led, in fact, for 12 of 13 rounds before losing was Maxime Bernier, who's a Quebec, a former minister with quite a long backstory I won't get into, but who was a libertarian candidate and a much more divisive candidate, somebody running on a vastly smaller role for government here, who I think was would have been a compelling story. I think he frightened off a lot of people in his party, so those who weren't initially supporting him were less likely to. Andrew Scheer was running second initially, and as each other candidate dropped off, he slowly accumulated enough support to put sort of a top just with 51% on the final ballot.
Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, he is sort of trying to position himself as the voice of the working man, sticking it to the, you know, ivory tower dwelling elitist, etc., etc., etc. Does that kind of culture war populism play in Canada, though?
It might. It bears noting that during the campaign, there was a candidate who ran much more aggressively on that, named Kelly Leach, who was an Ontario member of parliament, a former minister, who, and until before this, wasn't known as much of a populist, but then decided to run on sort of what you would call Donald Trump language, essentially. There was sort of a lot of talk about elites, a lot of what was perceived to be sort of implicit immigrant bashing, a real kind of right-wing populism. She didn't do well at all. I mean, she actually kind of bombed out in this, and despite getting an awful lot of attention by people who were kind of afraid of a Donald Trump redux here, she only got a few percentage points initially. So it didn't find that big an audience. That being said, I do think there's some sense of potential vulnerability for the Prime Minister here, for Justin Trudeau, who is very popular right now still, and I don't think is terribly vulnerable at the moment. But he's the son of a former prime minister. He's lived a pretty privileged lifestyle. He is seen to enjoy palling around with celebrities and elites and so on. There is something there. I'm frankly not even sure if it would be more vulnerable, if the Liberals here, the governing party, would be more vulnerable from the right or from the left. It's possible that the New Democrats or the left-wing party here might actually find more fertile ground. I do think in the long run it's a potential vulnerability, but I don't know that right now there's a whole lot of anti-elite anger. Certainly nothing like what you've gotten in the United States and in much of Europe.
Adam Rudwanski from The Globe and Mail, thanks for joining us. Coming up, the Asian newspapers and how to successfully remake bad television. Do stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Time now to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We are joined once again by Somnath Battabile, a lecturer in media in development and international journalism at SOAS. Somnath, we start with the Indian Express. This is a long, long editorial taking a look at a piece, taking a look at a story rather we've talked about a few times. This was the Human Shield incident in Kashmir. But this is a reflection, well, as it sets out at the top, between the Indian army and Indian democracy. And obviously, a democracy needs an army. But as this piece sees it, where are they getting that relationship wrong?
Well, you know, I mean, the problem which Pratap Bhanu Mehta, one of the leading intellectuals of the country, points out is how television-friendly army has become and how democracies and the population of the country seems to be egging the army on, and what are the pitfalls when something like that happens. Now, I mean, we have spoken about this so many times, Andrew, but if we just take it in a slightly larger perspective, post-independence and post-partition, the army has had a tough job in India. States in the northeast, Bangladesh liberation, Kashmir, that has been going on. But post-2000, something spectacularly has changed with television and TRP ratings coming in, and suddenly a very nationalist media egging the army on, and at the same time, a very strong liberal pro-human rights voice trying to say, hang on. I mean, things got really wrong when a supposed surgical operation on across the border about 3 or 4 months back was videoed and released to the media as if the army had to justify its existence. And of course, the recent one on Kashmir where a supposed stone pelter was put on the front of the jeep, and a very quick reaction from the army to give him a commendation medal. Suddenly you're playing your kind of striving to justify yourself to the nation. The army doesn't really need to do that. Until the late 1990s, they never did it. We took it as the fourth largest army. We took it as a clean institution. Suddenly, so many questions are being brought up because its very existence is being questioned. Why is it there? What is it doing? That's not, you know, you don't hear about the British army every day. You don't hear about the American army every day. Did they carry out huge amount of operations? But the Indian army is put on the spotlight all the time.
Okay, we should move along to another story addressing this is from Scroll, addressing another fundamental question, I guess, that India does need to face. The headline says it all, that India will have 1.7 billion people by 2050 and has to figure out how to feed them.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's a question which we keep ignoring. The government keeps ignoring us as
Well, that's, as it points out, that's an extra 430 million people in what, 33 years?
33 years.
So that's, I come from Australia, that's give or take, what's 25 into 430? That's about 17 more Australians in the next, God help us, in the next 30 years.
It's a question which should be uppermost, along with climate change, in the mind of the Indian government. You know, on one hand, you push your population out of the villages, the rural areas, into cities, and you want to have a 50-50 urban-rural population. That's devastating on what happens to the cities. Second, you have, at the moment, about 58% of the population engaged in agriculture, but the yield per year is going up only by less than 2%. This is dangerous. The Green Revolution is not going to happen again, what happened 30 years ago. And the results of the Green Revolution are also quite devastating. Of course, food production went up. So this is a question which the government and policies have to, you know, has to work out. But also look, Andrew, at the number of farmer suicides in India. Each month, about 4,000 farmers across India commit suicide.
Which is an astonishing figure. Yes, a sobering reading to say the very least, that one. It's a great piece by Mohan Guruswamy for Scroll. We move finally along to a... it's one of those ones, it is really hard to know what to say about this. The report is originally from the Deccan Herald, being reported here by another outlet who I don't like mentioning because they don't pay people. But nonetheless, it is one of those weird illustrative stories which, do please take it up.
Well, the Chief Minister of Uttar Pradesh, which is the largest state in the country, who is a clear pro-nationalist, pro-Hindutva, saffron-wearing gentleman, has gone to, and I say this with caution, a supposedly lower caste village. Mm-hmm. And before this, government servants in the payroll of the government has gone to this village and given the villagers soaps and shampoos and asked them to clean up. I mean, my God, have you actually... I mean, this is madness. I mean, not even some sense of...
Well, you were about to say, have I ever heard of such a thing? There is, of course, that ancient joke which holds that Queen Elizabeth II thinks the entire world smells of fresh paint.
You know, who am I to talk of the Queen? I can only talk of the Chief Minister of my country.
But nonetheless, it's one of those things where it obviously reveals something about the depth of the caste divide in India, but it also reveals... You would think that the chief minister has to have a word with his staff, because the thing is, like, a story like this is obviously going to get out in the modern world, is obviously going to go viral. And honestly, how does anybody working for a politician think this is going to work out well?
I don't know. This is a massive PR scandal. I realize
that is not the major issue.
but the other, I mean, you know, if you look at it in a slightly different way, the other issue is that they do not really care. They know they can get away with it each and every time. I mean, the government thinks that the army can do something and get away with it. The chief minister, I mean, look at the photograph of the chief minister with 17 people standing behind with guns. Actually, not 17, you can see only four. But I mean, when do you see, you know, minor politicians so armed, so aggressive, telling people what to do? I mean, it's a ridiculously nationalist government with a huge mandate, apparently able to do anything they feel like.
It's not a good look, no. But just finally and briefly, unfortunately, do stories like this being reported, especially internationally, damage the politicians at the heart of them or not?
I wish I could have a causal effect to this happens and they immediately fall down. It doesn't. I'm sorry to say.
Somnath Batabile from SOAS, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. Finally tonight, Nobody Expected, a soapy TV drama revolving around a group of California lifeguards to become one of the most watched programs in the world. Indeed, certainly not its original network, NBC, which cancelled the show after its first season. But of course, Baywatch, and don't pretend you didn't know what I was talking about, persevered and eventually ran for 11 seasons. It's back in theatres this week with a big screen adaptation. But as Ben Ryland reports now, the tide is still out on its box office appeal. Some people stand in the darkness, afraid to step into the light. Some people need to...
Say what you will about remakes, but they've been one of the most reliable devices in Hollywood's bag of tricks for far longer than the dawn of the talking picture. But from the moment news broke of a big screen interpretation of the classic 90s television series Baywatch, predictions of its beaching at the box office were rolling in, almost like an unwelcome storm front rudely interrupting a summer's afternoon. Baywatch opened on a holiday weekend in the United States, taking a projected $22 million, a lackluster result for a blockbuster budgeted at more than $60 million.
You turn the canals into the goddamn X Games.
Yeah, that's because we were in lifeguard pursuits.
Oh, okay. My bad.
Paramount's distribution chief, Megan Colligan, told Variety that they'd been stung by early bad reviews and pointed to the film's positive test screenings. The studio is hoping to repair some of that bad publicity as international openings continue. Baywatch's damp opening weekend also comes at a tricky time for Paramount's new CEO, Jim Giannopoulos. Compared to, say, Disney, with its live-action remakes of classic animated titles, not to mention the Star Wars and Marvel franchises, Paramount is struggling to build its own stable. If Baywatch turns out to be an international disaster, it would make the task ahead for Giannopoulos even more epic. Greenlighting a remake of a much-loved classic television series makes sense. The kids of the 90s who watched in awe as ripped, flesh-bearing lifeguards patrolled the beaches of California are now part of a grown-up and cashed-up demographic of ticket buyers. But it's the science of the remake that's much harder to master. Whether or not Baywatch is able to sail through its opening storm surge, it's part of a long line of TV to film adaptations that analysts will no doubt be considering when the box office post-mortem begins.
Here's the story of a lovely lady who was bringing up three very lovely girls.
Airing from 1969 to 1974, The Brady Bunch has become one of the most recognizable facets of American popular culture. The film version came more than 20 years after the series had ended, but rather than simply update the original premise, the adaptation cleverly sourced much of its humor from the syrupy, wholesome family setting of the original by placing the very naive 1960s Brady family in the very self-aware world of Los Angeles in the mid-90s. There was even a cameo appearance by celebrity drag queen RuPaul as guidance counselor Mrs. Cummings.
So, Jan, what can I help you with? Teen pregnancy, bulimia, suicidal tendencies?
No, it's my stupid glasses.
Oh.
The Brady Bunch movie opened at number one in the United States and took more than $50 million worldwide. But of course, not all remakes enjoy such success. From 1961 to 1969, British audiences loyally tuned in once a week to follow the sophisticated antics of spy duo John Steed and his various colleagues, most famously Emma Peel, in the classic series The Avengers. The programme has become a staple of Britain's television history, with reruns still airing today. But when its big screen adaptation came in 1998, critics were, well, initially, they weren't saying very much at all. Convinced they had a turkey on their hands, Warner Brothers quietly dropped it into theatres and looked the other way.
I believe you're in extreme danger. You'd better stay here with me.
Is that wise?
Well, you'll be safer here. We can talk things through. An official debriefing, no interruptions.
You live alone, no Mrs. Steed?
Ralph Fiennes took over the role of John Steed with Uma Thurman as his most famous colleague, Emma Peel. But where the original duo engaged in light, playful banter as they investigated strange and often quite eccentric crimes, Thurman appeared rather uncomfortable, while Fiennes seemed to have misinterpreted Steed's dry, grinning wit for damp grumpiness. The Avengers fell $12 million short of breaking even on its $60 million budget, and it's often considered one of the worst films of the 90s. So what is the formula of a successful remake? Well, the Brady Bunch's approach of rewrite, recast, and reinterpret doesn't always work either, as Nora Ephron found with her ill-fated 2005 disaster, Bewitched. During its original run, the classic sitcom used a fanciful scenario of the culture clash between a witch married to an average man's man of 1960s suburban America to lightly address some fairly topical questions of the era. The update paired Nicole Kidman with Will Ferrell as actors, playing the original's Samantha and Darren in a meta attempt at satirizing the Hollywood sausage machine. Audiences were mostly confused, and the film fell $22 million short of its $85 million budget. Then again, there's the 2012 adaptation of 21 Jump Street, which took more than $200 million worldwide, not to mention the ongoing Mission Impossible franchise, The Addams Family, and The Fugitive. When TV-to-film adaptations are done right, they either exist happily alongside the legacies of their forebears, or they eclipse them. So, the secrets of a good remake? Well, there are a few things just about all successful films share in common. A snappy script, interesting direction, and considered casting. No matter how known the original property might be, when it comes to opening weekend, history tells us that, most of the time, films will sink or swim on their own set of merits, and very few have ever recovered from soggy scripting.
Ben Ryland, host of Monocle 24 cinema show there. Tune into this Friday's show for a special look at the handcrafted side of modern movies, from title animation to poster design. And that is it for today's edition of The Daily. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. The researchers were Jolene Goffin and Christian Radev. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. The Globalist is here 8 hours from now. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.